Good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. I'm Scott Kennedy. I'm a senior advisor in the Freeman Chair in China Studies here and director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy. Although maybe we'll touch upon those today. We're here to talk about where China's historical trajectory helps us think about China's relationship with the world, with the United States, both today and looking into the future. As a undergraduate, a graduate student, as a citizen, I pay a lot of attention to history. But I'm not a historian, even though I try to read as much as possible. And so when I think about the big debates on Chinese history, at least from the perspective of my current responsibilities, I think about two big questions. The first is, if you're looking at trying to trace Chinese history, what is sort of the key theme in that story and the evolution or trajectory of China? Certainly, there are those who emphasize continuity between China's past and the present, and they think of the People's Republic as another dynasty, and Deng Xiaoping, Xi Jinping, and others as emperors, just wearing slightly different clothing. Some people emphasize China's relationship to communism and its socialist neighbors, in particular the role of Stalin in the foundation of China. And others emphasize China's evolution as a modern society, the growth of commercial markets, civil society, the possibility of democratization early in the 20th century, and then being cut off by the revolution, but now maybe we're seeing that resurgence. I don't know, those are the big debates that I remember as a graduate student and that I continue to look at. The second just has to do with a bigger question of what does a world where China is powerful look like? It's not a world that I ever have grown up in, but it looks like one that I might get old in. What does that mean for China, people in China? What's it mean for China's neighbors? And if China is a global power, it obviously has big implications for the rest of us. And hopefully history can give us some guide to that. Luckily today, we have several experts that can give us insight into these two questions and other questions that I'm not smart enough to have asked. And that's got to be a lot of questions about Chinese history. So Klaus Mulhan has written a terrific book, A Weighty Tomb, and I mean that literally. This baby is heavy. And if you have the chance to buy one and have to travel later today, be ready to pay a lot more for luggage allowance. But it's important. It's weighty in other respects in terms of the topics that it addresses. We then have two commentators who are going to speak as well, Steve Platt and Paul here. I want to introduce all three of the speakers now briefly. Then Klaus is going to give a presentation about his book. And then we're going to hear from the two commentators. We'll then come up here on stage, and then we'll take questions and have a conversation with all of you. So Klaus is a professor of Chinese history and culture and vice president at the Free University of Berlin. He's been there for the last 9 years. And prior to that, he was professor of history at Indiana University. And in fact, that's where we first met, since I was at Indiana University at the same time. His book, Criminal Justice in China, A History, won the John K. Fairbank Prize in East Asian History from the American Historical Association. And he's published widely on Chinese history in English, German, and Chinese, and is a frequent commentator on China for the German media. His doctorate from philosophy is from FU Berlin in 1998, and he's really one of the most renowned historians on modern China that we have in the West. Paul here served as National Intelligence Officer for East Asia, which is the senior analyst for East Asian affairs in the U.S. intelligence community, from 2007 to 2015. He originally started his career as an expert on Southeast Asia, but then turned his attention north to China. He served on the staff of the President's Daily Brief as a member of the CIA's Senior Analytics Service and the Senior Intelligence Service. Dr. Heer was a Robert E. Wilhelm Fellow at the Center for International Studies at MIT, and he is the author, most recently, of Mr. X and the Pacific, George F. Kennan and American Policy in East Asia, which was published by Cornell University Press just this past year. Steve Platt is a historian of modern China, specializing in 19th century history and foreign relations. His PhD is from Yale, where his dissertation won the university-wide Theron Rockwell Field Prize. Professor Platt's most recent book is Imperial Twilight, The Opium War and the End of China's Last Golden Age, which was published just last year as well. And his previous book, Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom, from 2012, was a military history of the Taiping Rebellion in Global Context and won the Kunthill History Prize. We couldn't have a better group of experts to talk about these topics. If you please join me in welcoming Klaus Mulhan to the stage.
So, first of all, I want to thank Scott for having me here today. I'm really delighted to have the possibility to be here and talk about my book. I'm also a little bit nervous because that is my first encounter with the policy world here in Washington and the think tanks. I'm more used to purely academic audiences, but I take that as something that is both a great chance and also for me really exciting, because I have always thought or always think, and it was actually part of that, the intention behind the book, that it's necessary for historians to talk with people beyond the discipline, beyond the merely academic discipline. So I really appreciate to have the chance to do this today. I wanted to do I have about 30 minutes, and I wanted to do basically proceed in three steps, if you will. I would like to first explain how the book differs from the books that are out there and what that's related to what motivated me to go into the book in the first place. And second, I would like to highlight a couple of my main intentions behind writing this book, what was important to me, what was the aspects that I tried to pay attention, and then I would like to take up some of the questions that Scott asked that I think can be viewed or portrayed as conclusions from the historical narrative that relate to the China that we see today and some of the problems or some of the challenges or some of the uniqueness that we have to deal with. So first of all, why write such a book? There are books out there about the history of China, and these are good books, to make that very clear. And when I'm not talking about these books, I mainly refer to the larger general histories that cover a longer time span. This, our field, Chinese history, is extremely diverse. It has made lots of progress in the recent decades, related, for instance, to greater accessibility to the archives in China, greater accessibility to do field work in China. People are able to spend more time in China than before, let's say before, I'm thinking about the 1950s and 60s. So it's a very diverse field. There's been a lot of progress, a lot of excellent work being done. But this work is not reflected in the larger general survey histories that we have. And I think the last two examples of these survey histories have been published at the end of the 1990s, around the time of the Tiananmen massacre. And that is, however, a long time. And China has changed profoundly in that period. So these older histories, they were written under the impression of a China that is still lagging behind, following wrong, mistaken policies, mostly, of course, that was related to the Mao Zedong era. These texts saw China as backward, For them, China was beholden to tradition that didn't allow China to become modern. So I think most where these history started was actually to explain why China has these enormous difficulties to join the modern world. And obviously, this is not entirely wrong, because that was the China that these writers, great historians, would see when they looked at the China in their time. So, however, these notions or history started to run up against the developments in China starting in the 1990s, and of course this would accelerate in the 2000s. So as skyscrapers shot up in major cities, as high-speed trains crisscrossed the country with a precision and a punctuality, I must say, that we don't reach and achieve in Germany, yeah? As technological leadership in areas such as artificial intelligence is at least close to be attained in China, some people say it has already been, I don't know. And as technological feats such as the historic landing of an unmanned spacecraft on the back of the moon a couple of weeks ago were celebrated in China, I think the assumptions that the main thing that we need to explain why China is not modern is more and more obsolete or at least no longer relevant. China has become, at least partially, in terms of technology, if you understand it that way, or in terms of economic development, definitely modern, I would say, more modern than some countries in Europe. So what we now have to explain as historians has entirely changed. It's no longer why China is backward, it's why such a surprising and unexpected economic, technological, social development in breakneck speed was possible. A development that is unprecedented in human history. I think it's no exaggeration to say that never has a history in a society been so fundamentally transformed in such a short period of time by economic growth, social change, and technological development. And hardly anybody in the West, I remember that very clearly, thought that this was possible in the first place. During my first day in China, I read the newspaper and Deng Xiaoping had just said, mid-1980s, that it will take China will surpass Great Britain in 50 years. And when we look at in terms of the economy, of course it's not the entire picture, but if you just look at the economy, it's already happened. And I remember people at that time said, this is impossible. China was one of the poorest countries in the world in the 1980s. Thus, this is precisely the impossibility and unexpectedness of the Chinese development that calls for an historical explanation. Because if this was possible in China, it surely must have had historical factors that played a role. So China's development is also in need of explanation because it's one of the most momentous developments of our time. Global conditions have already shifted significantly, and the effects are felt everywhere. Many of the dramatic political and social changes in the US, but also in Europe, that we can read about in the news, lead us directly or indirectly back to China. The loss of industrial jobs, for instance, in certain parts of Europe, and the resulting political and social upheavals, stagnant wages in Western industrialized societies, increased competition in global markets, higher costs for raw materials or food or energy, of course, can all be directly attributed to the development in China. Chinese policies are also driving competition in fields like digitalization, artificial intelligence. China is also, of course, contributing to global climate change. Of course, it should also be mentioned that China's development has offered a lot of opportunities that Europe and America have profited from. China's huge market has contributed significantly to global economic growth and added wealth to Europe and the US over the last decade. The profits of all the major global companies would be much smaller without the Chinese market, and you all know when Apple recently reported sales issues in China, its stock slipped significantly. So taking all this together, I thought it's time to write a revisionist history, a history that is deeply revisionist against the leading general texts currently in circulation. That at least was my ambition. If I succeeded, I leave this to others to judge. So in contrast to the existing scholarship, the book does not treat China's contemporary transformation as a postscript or an afterthought. The book accepts the fact, that's the starting point, that China has become and is now a major and powerful player in the world, based on its own achievements and successes in tackling some of the problems that the country faced historically. Also, unlike an earlier generation of scholarship, I try to move away from conventions of binary framing, such as the United States and China. And for somebody coming from Europe, of course, it's obvious that I also bring Europe and Germany in. But I really also try to place modern Chinese history at the center of an interconnected and truly global network of engagement. That includes also areas of Africa, Latin America, and other parts of the world, because China has been engaged with these regions in the world for almost 100 years, if not much longer. So that includes also that I try to link domestic politics to international dynamics. So overall, it was my intention to offer a new narrative, to seek to approach China on its own terms, highlighting both the achievements and the problems and the setbacks in the ambitious undertaking by Chinese people to make their country modern. In order to write this, and now I come to the second part, the approach. In order to write this, I thought really long how this could be done. And I thought I came up with two, let's call it principles when I wrote, that influenced then the approach. The first was, I wanted to connect the present and the past in a very systematic way. The changes and challenges of our time consistently therefore serve as the starting point for when I went or moved into Chinese history. So I was interested in the past behind the China that we see today, the underlying drivers behind current changes. They are the front and center of the book. Decisions in the past have always consequences for the present, and I don't understand this in a monocausal or deterministic way, but in a sense that it shapes the spectrum of subsequent choices. So understanding today's China requires, I believe, a deep historical approach. History plays a major role in China's evolution, and I will give you some examples later on. I move now to the second principle of writing this book, and that was to say, I thought that a new history of China should not only describe, document, narrate, but above all, explicate, elucidate. Far too many historical works on China are content with the description or documentation of developments. As a consequence, when it comes to analytics or analytical thinking, I think many people do no longer look to the discipline of history, but rather to political science, economists, sociologists. I think this is a problem, and given the urgency and massiveness of the global changes and challenges of our time, many of which have a history, most of them have a history, and have roots in the past, I think it's necessary for historians to rediscover or re-embrace historical thinking. For me, historical analysis means clarify correlations, seek for causes, explain consequences, identify drivers behind developments. Of course, this cannot be done by looking simply to the literature of historians. It's needed then that the historian must leave the sheltered space of his discipline and engage in the risky business of reading and learning from other disciplines. So I tried to consult a wealth of secondary literature from disciplines other than history, such as demography, economics, human geography, social sciences. I also looked into climate science and cultural anthropology. So In order to avoid, however, overwhelming the reader with dates and names, because I'm covering the book covers a time period from 1644 to the present, that's a lot of time and a lot of names and dates. And I thought that's not going to helpful to the reader to kind of flood them with too many of these dates. Of course, some things are important. I therefore looked, that's my third aspect here, I looked at how China has organized itself over the past century and a half. The institutions, the ways of governing, the world's most populous nation. I tried to not have it too abstract. Of course, there are still people and ideas, and I quote from a lot of texts and so on. But nonetheless, as an overarching guiding principle, I was interested in institutions. Institutions understood as written or unwritten rules that allow people to work together. Right? In a society, people need to work together, and that's mostly based on some sort of conventions or understanding that creates mutual trust that comes with sharing rules, common assumptions, expectations, and values. I think this approach helps the reader understand important continuities from the imperial era to the Republican, the communist, and through to today's 21st century economic juggernaut. This approach explains China's development, points to a country that, because of its unique institutions and its unique experiences, won't go the way of other rivals of tomorrow, but will remain an important country to be reckoned with for the rest of the century. And I think here we can already draw one conclusion. That is, and now I move on to the third part of trying to use the history and draw conclusions that are relevant for today. And I think the first one that is for me also one of the clearest is that understanding the process of the development of modern China, that is not a development driven by outside influence and intervention. And that's pretty much a very clear distinction between my work and many of the other survey histories that we have. China's history was not the outcome of adhering to foreign models or impacts. Rather, it was based on a set of unique Chinese institutions, again, rules that help people work together, which China established or reformed to deal with external challenges or internal problems. This is not to say that China didn't learn from the outside world. But it is for me very clear that it was relying on its own traditional experiences, even when it learned from the outside world. An essential truth, therefore, emerges from the historical record as I see it. China's fate is being written domestically. It's not pressure from outside that will make or break China's development, but its own decisions and institutions. This has been the case in the last 150 years, even under grim and difficult circumstances, and it will be even more true with a China that is wealthier and stronger. My narrative then starts, in order actually to prove this point, starts with the Qing Dynasty, 1916-44. And I take, the narrative up until the present. Why do I start in 1644? I was interested in China at that time because China at that time was, we can say, it demonstrated great strength, material effervescence, social stability, saw enormous expansions of territory and population in an increasingly commercialized but primarily agrarian economy. And that, of course, shows these were very sophisticated institutions. Its industries, for example, were among the world's most advanced. In the 19th century, however, the country fell far behind European competitors. Within the relatively short period of 100 years, a comparatively prosperous and well-administered country at the edge of modernity turned into a nation of chaos, corruption, backwardness, and poverty. It really was impoverished at the end of the 19th century, a situation that was not the case 100 years ago. Flourishing rural cities declined into neglect and destitution. It's interesting, a side remark, because historians are often not so much interested in these processes when societies fall into decline or crisis. We rather like to tell the story of rises, yeah, rising empires, rising nation states. But I think it's equally relevant to look for the causes of what brings a society to fall apart. And this is exactly what happened in the 19th century. In my narrative, mentions a couple of factors, but in general, I try to portray it as something. I reject most of the explanations that are out there that it's Confucianism or that it's imperialism. These are the two main theories that are normally believed to have caused China's decline. But I think it's mostly driven by economic problems, that the economy in Imperial China encounters a crisis that has something to do with global changes, the availability of silver. At that time, it's very well known. We also see other problems. In general, the global market is shifting, but it's also because some of the main export items that China had successfully sold to Europe, porcelain, it can no longer be sold because it's being produced in Europe. And from the same quality. It's, by the way, one of the first cases of that Europe, of course, acquired technologies from China that then undermined China's global economic position. So I think this is, for me, a main driver of the crisis in the 19th century. Then it puts stress on government institutions. It puts stress on social institutions. It causes the spreading of rural poverty. And then, of course, we have challenges by foreign capital, new technologies, Western knowledge, new institutions that go into the treaty port world. That's the world of the harbors and treaty ports along the coast. So to make that short, I see also a major cause in what happens in the realm of politics. Because in a rapidly changing world, China lacked the leadership to respond to new challenges and adjust to new realities. It became painfully apparent that China also needed political institutions capable of mobilizing its economic and human resources in order to find solutions for these new stresses, but it could not agree on the need to act. The reason for that, I believe, was mainly that the Manchu court was above all concerned with protected vested interests and maintaining power. With this priority overruling all other considerations, institutional changes were avoided for fear of undermining the rule of the Manchu dynasty. So the root cause of China's 19th century crisis then can be found in the closely aligned incentives of the imperial household and the bureaucratic, scholarly, commercial elites. This created a tight web of vested interests and rent-seeking behavior, which once established impeded institutional change and proved extremely difficult to remove. So it's when institutions become beholden to special interests that a society loses its ability to respond or adequately deal with these problems. That is my main argument to the crisis. Now, the crisis then, in the book, is the starting point for efforts to restore China or to reform China for about 150 years, a process that is still ongoing. So for the subsequent history, that means for me that the decades that we see now, where China is entering the world again, they are merely the latest chapter of a much longer development. Since the end of the 19th century, since this 19th century crisis, Chinese elites across the political spectrum have aspired to recover China's lost position. They have been thinking within a specific Chinese idiom framed the world in long-term perspectives, more, I think, than the West normally appreciates. They constituted a sense of China's rightful place in the world according to Chinese historical experiences. So China's historical trajectory has been a 150-year-long, steady but also rocky and painful return to eminence and centrality, fueled, however, by persistent aspirations that transcended political divisions in the country. And I have many quotes in the book that actually show that regardless of its Beijing officials, nationalists in the Kuomintang, even communists in Mao Zedong, often having a similar rhetoric when it comes to reclaiming China's position in the world. Second, for making China prosperous and strong again, the elites persistently brought about changes of the institutional order. And if anything, for me, distinguishes China from other countries, then it's this interest in changing the rules of the game, so to speak, right? Coming up with new institutions, reforming older institutions, getting rid of the examination system, replacing it with new examination systems. Reforming, you know, getting rid of the imperial administration, but replacing it with other forms of central administration, of course. So the effort here was to overcome institutional weaknesses and dysfunctionalities through experiments, revolutions, and reforms, drawing on China's own experiences, because these institutions always were, in a way, also continued. And continued and transferred, and on a wide and highly selective range of foreign models. Each of these institutional reforms and transfers left its mark on China. The result is an hybrid and actually unique mixture that can be easily observed in the present, where we see institutions, again, rules from the Soviet era, next to traditional institutions, next to ones transferred or learned from Western societies. That is actually, even if you just look at visually, it's visible. In this next to next of different elements that are sitting next to each other. And I think that explains frequent policy shifts and also an inherent stability. So two more points. Historical advantages play a big role. It's also something that I think distinguishes my book from the other books that are out there. Historical advantages upon which China could build included, for instance, this comparative sophistication of pre-modern Chinese institutions, an ingrained emphasis on meritocracy and education, and the long experience of having run such a complex administrative organization as the Chinese imperial bureaucracy, and the unmatched experience in administering a huge and multi-ethnic cultural space. And this is not only something that is today's China has kind of revived, but we can see, for instance, commitment to education and science that is basically can be demonstrated consistently throughout the 20th century. The first great universities in China were built established over 120 years ago. It is also during that time of the late years of the Qing that there was already a clear commitment to building and promoting education, including science. Other examples for me include investment in infrastructure, a consistent effort of all Chinese governments throughout the 20th century to build railroads, to build airports, to build canals and dams and so on. Also something that the imperial government has already done. Let me give you another example. There is the experience in running efficient and highly competitive markets. Clearly something that we can, that colleagues and historians have shown very clearly for the imperial period, late imperial period. Chinese markets at that time, commodity or service markets, were sophisticated, well-organized, extremely competitive, and very efficient. And also this is something I think that, for instance, we have to factor in when we want to explain the development of China in the last 30 years, because after the Cultural Revolution, it's amazing how quickly markets were revived, although they were out of function for several decades. So the historical legacy of its own experiences and institution and the creative adaptation of broad spectrum of novel institutional forms eventually allowed China to arrive at adequate institutional solutions for some of its long-term problems facing the country, but others not. So I would like to, I think, how much time do I still have, Scott? Okay, good, excellent. So we should, however, I would like to mention two more thoughts here. When we discuss the historical development, also, of course, we have to mention and we have to point out that the development was also partial and unfinished. And now we come to the terrain of politics. The biggest unresolved issue facing China today, but also throughout the entire 20th century, is that China removed political institutions that have been key to past stability during the long period of the Chinese Empire, most notably the Emperor, Imperial Administration, local gentry, and so on. To replace these, China has, over the course of the 20th century, cherry-picked from the global menu of political institutional models, subsequently opting for a constitutional monarchy in the early 20th century, a constitutional republic after 1912, military dictatorships in the warlord period, a number of them, a constitutional republic, military dictatorships, a Chinese version of fascism in the 1930s. We think about Chiang Kai-shek's interest in Nazi Germany and probably even more so in Mussolini's fascist Italy, and several forms of state socialism, including Stalinism and the Chinese variant Maoism. So we have a whole range of political institutions or models that were used or that Chinese elites tried to adapt. The various models have one characteristic in common, however. They were all extractive political institutions. And by extractive political institutions, I mean institutions that concentrate power in the hands of a narrow elite, such as military officers or party leaders. So while China experimented creatively in the modern period, its ruling authorities showed little interest in building institutions that would distribute power widely or would support political pluralism. Even after 1978, no convincing, enduring, and efficient equivalent to the country's economic liberalization has been established. On the contrary, economic development was decoupled from the political development. In addition to that, we have also to see another commonality of all Chinese governments in the 20th century, namely they were established on the battlefield, resulting in unstable political conditions. In each case, victory was achieved with violence and it often needed to be defended with more violence. This fundamentally compromised the ability to govern, and governments faced more dissent, saw greater opposition, resorted to more repression. Political systems forged on the battlefield and through military campaigns, of course, lack a basis. They can only be unsure about the popular support they have. In the end, people weren't asked. There was no alternative. It was a fact. And economic growth, of course, can make up for that deficit, as has been successfully shown in China since 1978, but it's unstable. Because economic growth is cyclical, as we know, It depended on developments outside of China's control, such as the global market. And my book, for instance, shows that that was already the case in the early modern period. And it can therefore not be maintained forever. So basing one's support, or what people, political scientists say, legitimacy, on economic growth is risky at best. And of course, the government tries with other forms, for instance, nationalism, to buttress the regime in critical moments. So I come to a short conclusion. We see now a stronger China that seems to be, or the government seems to be in control, a China that defends its own development model called the China model or the Beijing consensus, promotes it as a better version of development. However, there's also a mismatch between China's appearance and its real strength, given the fact that in some areas, as we have talked, economics, China has been very successful, but others, like politics, it's much less clear. So for me, that means historically, such a situation when these things are unresolved or unclear, it of course allowed and even facilitated the ability of leaders to gain greater control and power. But as a consequence, just as in the past, China's government can at once be powerful, but also powerfully insecure. Hence, I believe that it's probably less China's strength and renewal in the 21st century than its unresolved issues, or its uneven development, and its profound anxieties that will shape the world of the 21st century. Thank you very much.
And I'll have you go first.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you go to the far end?
There?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Steal my. Yeah.
Okay. We can
you're gonna talk from here.
Great. Yeah. Are we turned on yet?
Yes. Yes. Klaus, that was terrific. Thank you so much for a very lucid talk, inspirational, and your book does have an edge. It does have a clear, provocative element that pushes on a lot of historians, but it also, of course, has great implications for how we think about China in global society today and where it's going, which affects the policy community's analysis and our policy towards China. So thank you so much for your talk. Why don't we turn first to Steve and then to Paul for some initial comments, and then we'll open it up to the audience. Steve? Right.
Can I hold the book?
For sure. For sure.
Making China modern. I'll keep my remarks short just so we can get to a wider conversation more quickly. I know a lot of you have questions. But as a fellow historian, I wanted to talk a little bit about my impressions on reading this book, and especially just how impressed I am at what a huge undertaking it is to try to write a comprehensive history of China from 1644 all the way to the present. It means that the historian writing it has to cut across a huge range of fields of specialty, and necessarily they have to go outside of their own areas of research and try to judge what among the current scholars is most important. And I mean, the closest resonance it had for me was a book that looks very similar, equally thick, also with a red cover, which is The Search for Modern China by Jonathan Spence, which was sort of the seminal text from in the 90s and the 2000s. And this is very much sort of, it's of an equal weight, both in a scholarly sense and in a physical sense, and in how comprehensive it is. It resembles Search, but it's very different. And I wanted to talk a little bit about those differences and why those differences exist. And Klaus already hinted at that in his talk. So on the one hand, this is a wonderful synthesis of current scholarship. It's cutting-edge research in the field of history. As you read through it and as it goes through familiar events, they are told in very unfamiliar ways, those of you who are accustomed to more conventional histories. So there's no better book out there that I know of for trying to get sort of the state of the field of history of China as it exists right now. On the other hand, it's also a story with a very different kind of a focus. As he said, his focus is on institutions, and it asks a very different set of questions. And above all, the reason for that, and this also is something that you talked about momentarily in your talk, which is that this was written in a very different present than The Search for Modern China was. When The Search for Modern China was written, it was in the early 90s. China was still trying to recover from the Mao years, and prior to that, trying to recover from World War II, and if you want to go further back, trying to recover from the decline and fall of the Qing Dynasty. And from the standpoint of the early 90s, the dominant question was, could China ever be modern? That it was sort of this ongoing quest that never had come to fulfillment. Could China ever be strong and respected again as it had in the past? And as that book, The Search for Modern China, was written in the immediate aftermath of Tiananmen, it was really, it gave a great weight to sort of visionaries and especially martyrs, those who had sought change in China and were destroyed in the process. Now, the writing of history, even if we try to avoid it as historians, always speaks to the present that we live in, because it's the present moment that helps to determine what's interesting to us and what seems important and significant in the past. And the present for which this particular book was written was almost unimaginable in the early 1990s, that China could be this powerful, this strong, have such a strong economy. And so the questions become entirely different ones. Instead of asking, will China ever become strong, it now seems obvious that China can be strong and is strong. And the questions looking back towards its history are to see what were its sources of strength in the past, and during that interim period from the Opium Wars up until the 1970s, what was it that prevented China from achieving the kind of strength that it had held in the past. So in looking at that, I mean, that long period from the late 19th to the early, really the mid-20th centuries, Klaus sees this in sort of a shifting world of Chinese institutions, of various attempts to respond to changes within China, changes in the world as it existed around China, so many models that were attempted along the way to try to bring order back. And he asks the question constantly, why did some of these take root? And why did others fail? How could China establish modern institutions that worked in the contemporary world in which those institutions were being established, while at the same time being able to resonate with and draw from China's traditional strengths from the past? So what I hope you will talk a bit more about, and maybe we can talk about in the Q&A, is that elusive balance between China addressing the present world and the conditions of the immediate moment versus the weight and the power of historical tradition. And in reading this book, the question that I wanted you to talk more about is that, is this more a story of how the world changed and how institutions that had served China in the past no longer served as well in this new world, and it's simply taken China about 200 years to regain its footing, and now it will go on as before? Or is it more important that there were essential things about China in and of itself that shifted and which governments needed to come to terms with in order to bring an internal order? So if you could talk a little bit about that.
I'll hand it over to Paul now.
Sure. Okay, yeah. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, in the interest of time, I will try to be concise and make a few points as succinctly as I can. And Scott did invite us to be provocative, so I'll try to volunteer to do that as well. I mean, my first thought was that I was very almost intimidated at being put up here on stage with two such distinguished historians, because although my academic credentials are as a historian, I figured that my value added here was that I supplemented that with my experience 30 years as an intelligence analyst and officer, where one of my primary jobs was to try to inform China policy deliberations and China policy debates. And because of that combination, I tried very much during the course of my career and since to inject history into the policy deliberations. So I think I want to start there, basically, because I want to add some contemporary policy relevance, where I think this all fits into the policy debate. And my starting point really would be that I think there's a hole in the middle of the policy debate in its kind of inattention to history. In fact, I would go farther to say that the policy debate, to a certain extent, is being informed. It's almost ahistorical in terms of some of the assumptions and premises that underlie it, which I think are highly problematic. I mean, for example, the national security strategy asserts that China is attempting to erode American security and prosperity, to shape a world antithetical to U.S. values and interests. It also seeks Indo-Pacific regional hegemony in the near term and displacement of the United States to achieve global preeminence in the future. With the exception of the regional hegemony issue, and I hope we come back to that, my bottom line is that I don't think that such an expansive and aggressive and absolutist characterization of China's strategic ambitions is supported by the historical record as presented in Klaus's book. Partly because I think it overlooks and dismisses, and Klaus mentioned this, the reactive and the defensive elements of China's mindset and the extent to which China's international behavior is driven by this historical sense of vulnerability. Now, don't get me wrong, I do believe that China poses an unprecedented and substantial, profound strategic challenge to the United States. But I think that the prevailing view mischaracterizes the historical origins of this challenge and the nature of it. And I think that how you address the problem has a lot to do with correctly diagnosing it. And I would add, actually, that not only does the policy debate seem to be inattentive to a better understanding of Chinese history, it frankly is inattentive to a better understanding of our role in it. I just want to quote in Vice President Pence's policy speech on China at the Hudson Institute last October. He said, "When China suffered through indignities and exploitations during her so-called century of humiliation, America refused to join in and advocated the open door policy so that we could have freer trade with China and preserve their sovereignty. I think the only part of that quotation that's historically correct is the reference to us advocating the open door policy so we could have freer trade with China. We were not in the position to use it to enforce their sovereignty. And we can cite chapter and verse about the U.S. role in what the Chinese call their central humiliation historically. But I would just cite the example to be inattentive to the significance in Chinese history of the May 4th movement, what provoked it, and the U.S. role in that, I think, is inattentive to a better understanding of how to deal with China. So just a couple other things I would add from that. I think that the central value of the book, which I can't say enough about, is that it essentially offers a more compelling explanation of why Chinese behave the way they do, and it's not for some of the reasons that are inherent in the debate. This historical Chinese mindset. The other one key element of that that Klaus mentioned in his introductory remarks is the extent to which it's not just a Chinese Communist Party mindset. He made the point that the CCP and the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, had essentially the same nationalist origins. In fact, in the book he said they shared a basic worldview as revolutionary parties, both dreaming of an independent and strong China without foreign imperialism. The way I like to characterize that is that the Chinese Communist Party did not invent Chinese nationalism. Chinese nationalism invented the Chinese Communist Party and the Kuomintang and will outlive them. He also mentioned some of the other commonalities, which I think draw in not just the KMT and the CCP, but the Qing government itself. This notion that he highlighted of them both all being extractive political institutions that were not interested in political pluralism. The book also highlights the extent to which all of them were driven, were kind of national development states, which is certainly central to the policy debate today about how the Chinese govern their economy. The Qing, late Qing, the Republican government under the KMT and the CCP were all state-driven but market-oriented, is one of the ways that he characterizes it. They were also, certainly the CCP and the KMT were both Leninist organizations. All three institutions used social transformation campaigns. Again, my point here is just that there's a lot in common that suggests that we have more to deal with than just a Chinese communist mindset. The second point I would emphasize here that not only is it not just a Chinese Communist Party mindset, it's not just Xi Jinping. There's a lot of commentary and some assumptions, I think, in the policy debate, which attribute a lot of what the Chinese are trying to accomplish to Xi Jinping. But I think Klaus's book very clearly demonstrates how most of the elements of Xi Jinping's worldview and his foreign policy are things that he largely inherited from his immediate predecessors. Certainly Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao talked a lot about wealth, the pursuit of wealth and power, the core missions of the party. And I guess the point I would emphasize most here is that the China dream, Xi Jinping's goal of national rejuvenation, is basically the latest version of the self-strengthening movement that goes back 150 years. Two other quick points about that. I mean, I think in that context, too, the book also highlights that the crackdown and the retrenchment and the kind of retreat of the reform program that Xi Jinping is overseeing, it's very clear from the book that this arguably is just the latest cycle since the reform program was launched 40 years ago of retrenchment and reform. The party's central policy debate since then has been about what is the appropriate balance of reform, what should the scope and pace of it be. And Klaus in the book talks about how this transition from an emphasis on growth to more balanced development of under Hu Jintao was only a predecessor to what Xi Jinping has been doing in terms of cracking down. I won't go into the details, but the book also explains how the Tiananmen Square crackdown and the Soviet collapse, I think, were much more influential in terms of this much more repressed approach to policy debate and reform. So the bottom line, really, is that I think the book outlines a great explication of China's international behavior, this pursuit of wealth and power, this opportunity to do so since China has its act together for the first time in 150 years, the extent to which is still driven by China's view of vulnerabilities and the economic requirements of domestic legitimacy, the requirements abroad. I think the new element that I hope we talk more about is that in the last generation, we've seen this kind of shift where the Chinese are being driven in part by their international behavior, not just by the perceived needs in their mindset, but the perceived opportunities that flow from the clout that they've enjoyed over the last 20 years. And I think they've perceived a series of historical events, which I think Klaus identifies in the book, as enhancing opportunities for them. The Soviet collapse actually validated their view of their model as being the right one if it's pursued in the correct way, which the Soviets didn't do. I think that was reinforced by the collapse of some of the Cold War structures internationally. China's certainly playing a role. More recently, the global financial crisis has enhanced China's perception of the opportunity to reclaim this greater role, and simply the fact that it has a lot more clout and capabilities, both economically and militarily, than in the past. The question, I think, that's unanswered, and I think Klaus touches on it in the book, is whether this greater perception of opportunities in addition to needs might somehow lead to an expansion of China's international ambitions. Anyway, I have a lot of other questions I could ask Klaus, but I think I'll turn it over back to Scott now.
Sure. Thank you very much, Paul. Thank both of you for your comments. And I definitely want to get the audience to weigh in here first. But do you want to initially have some reactions to what Steve and Paul said about and some of the couple of questions that they raised briefly before we go to the audience?
Yes, very briefly. First of all, I really want to thank both of you for the thought and these excellent comments and also the questions. And I think I'm really honored to have that. The question, as Steve is question, as put forward, of course, you know, how the relationship in the world, or how the changes in the world and the changes in China, kind of relate to each other, and what has actually primacy? I mean, is it actually the changes in China? Can we look at them in isolation? And so, and that is certainly that is something that I wanted to put in a, some say, very nuanced and differentiated way, because, you know, in the field we have, of course, the idea that the impact, the outside impact that was, you know, put on China was decisive and very, very important. I, on the other hand, wouldn't want to fall back in a position where we are only China-centered, right, where it's only a Chinese story. So my effort was to actually show how these things are really interwoven, but not in a simple way. So it's a constant exchange of ideas, of thoughts and techniques, some of them taken over and rejected, others taken over and modified and further developed. So that's what I tried to say. So a simple answer to this is, for me, it's actually both. But it's as it is in a globalized world, really enmeshed and interwoven, and therefore there's also a sort of dependency between these two storylines and developments. And then quickly to Paul, I mean, these are excellent points. I think you are absolutely right. I just would like to take up the last question, as I think it's really a very relevant, and it's also one where I see that where I'm not, you know, where the book stops, because I find it's very clearly to identify what's happening and where the journey or where the trip is going. So these greater opportunities, I think what has always struck me is that China so skillfully used global opportunities, you're absolutely right, and so from the entire 20th century, very skillfully used them. And of course, however, it was always unsure how to conceive of its own role. You know, it's clearly that it had to pursue some narrow interests, but I think I find it very difficult, even for today, but also in the past, to identify what China really wants in the world. It wants to be a strong player. It wants to be strong and powerful. But what does it want to do with the power? That's unclear. So, therefore, the book reflects of a sort of, you know, I think it's very hard to identify for me.
Terrific, terrific. Okay, we're going to open things up to the audience. We have someone coming around with a microphone, and we're live online, so please wait for the mic. If you'd identify yourself and your institution, where you come from, and keep your question relatively brief into a question, we're going to start over here with Ambassador Roy.
Stapleton Roy. I'm with the Wilson Center, the Kissinger China Institute there. Thank you for your very intellectually exciting presentation and for the book you've written. Too much of modern Chinese history begins with the Opium War, as taught in the West, which takes China at its period of weakness, and therefore we end up with the question, can China ever really overcome that period? I think the fact that you covered the entire Qing and the period of Kangxi and Qianlong when China was height of its power and in many ways was the most advanced country in the world gives you much better perspective. But what struck me about your comments were, you referred to the fact that in the late Qing, the reform efforts failed because of the rulers' fear of playing with reform and they wanted to hold on to their power, and they were also captured by special interests. Well, that's highly relevant to the ending of your book, where we're dealing with the question of why did the third plenum in 2013, the reform program there, has moved nowhere. And in fact, Xi Jinping seems to be moving backwards in terms of his attitude on reform. And we have Nick Lardy's new book, The State Strikes Back, in which he reverses his view and sees China doubling down on the least productive elements in China's economy, which is the state-owned sector, at the expense of the private sector. And my question, and you also toy with Min Xinpei's concept of a trapped transition. And if you put them together, I'd be interested in your comments, because the key difference is that you could argue that Xi Jinping is afraid of reform, because his number one goal is trying to shore up the legitimacy of Communist Party rule. But at the same time, he's been captured by these gigantic state-owned enterprises, which are special interests, very hard to take on in a head-on way. But then the question arises, and you touch on this at the end of your book. He's making the contradictions in China's current situation worse by essentially moving backwards instead of riding with the reform forces. And that raises a whole bunch of interesting questions, because the late Qing reformers were operating from a period of continued decline in the Qing dynasty. But Xi Jinping is operating at a time when China has had this most exciting 40-year period of rapid economic growth. And yet we see parallels in the fear of reform because of the impact it will have on ruling and the capturing by special interests and the problems that that creates for China to continue its development process. Sorry, it's a longer question than asked, but.
Yeah, good question though.
No, it's great, and it makes me really very happy also, because when I wrote the Lei Qing part, I really wrote it, you know, that I thought the parallels to what's happening in the present period or in China today are just striking. But of course, history doesn't repeat itself. And your point, of course, to the very big difference, that China today is in a very different shape in state than it is in the past. However, I do think the Lei Qing example shows us the failure or the risks of delaying necessary reform. So the way I explained this to me in the Lei Qing, timing was also of the essence. Many things in the Lei Qing were done ultimately, but it was, I would say, too little and too late. But timing is important. So that means the risks are increasing the longer China delays that thing. So, and that could undermine it, even if it's in a stronger position. I think the effects or the ripples it will send to the world, if you know problems and crises, will be more felt than in China in the Qing period. So we will not be able to isolate ourselves. But I think delaying it has exactly the same risk as in the Lei Qing time. And as I said, delaying means in 20 years, the story will be totally different. And then probably some of the strengths that we see now, who knows if that will be there.
So I guess what you're saying is there could be a historically useful story that fits what you're thinking, even if China doesn't continue to rise, even if it runs into problems, it still could fit the broader story. So that's not necessarily a test of your framework, in fact. Yeah. Okay. All right, we're going to come right here, and then we'll come over here. All right.
I've been asked to stand. My name is Dr. Rakab Malik. I'm a Fulbright scholar currently at the Seeger Center in the Elliott School. That's good enough. I'm going to be more sharp-focused here and relate to your understanding of the historical past. How does that impinge upon the drive for connectivity through, for example, the Belt and Road Initiative? And what would the impact be? They're forming new institutions, but not locally or just domestically, but internationally also. And what are the challenges that the West faces in this respect with an historical perspective.
I didn't hear the beginning of your question acoustically.
Hey, come on. Is it going to clarify his question?
No, I wanted to take it back to your understanding of the historical perspective and how that impinges upon modern policy and the future, as far as China's concerned, and the BRI.
Okay, I saw it. Right, okay, yeah, got it. Well, I mean, with the Belt and Road Initiative, I find it very, very hard to find, to see historical precedent. Because I think, the Silk Road economies, of course, were very, very important for China in the past, but they were of a very different nature. They were not related with institution building. But it was really truly, as far as my understanding, it was really a trade that was conducted along the Silk Road. So it was really focused on trade and exchange of goods. So I'm kind of a little bit skeptical, right, when it comes to connecting the Belt and Road Initiative to anything that we see in the Chinese past. China did for a long time hesitate to build or to be too engaged in the world beyond its border. For instance, we have the so-called tribute system. That was the main system that China used to regulate its relationship to East Asia. And the tribute system, in my mind, is above all characterized by the hesitancy of the Chinese emperor to send troops, to be involved, to send people, I mean, not troops in terms of conflict, they did this, but to send people or administrative staff or build up any presence in Vietnam, in Korea, in Burma, or elsewhere. So I don't see the historical connection so much, or can't answer that question in terms of if there is a continuity.
You guys want to weigh in on BRI and history?
I mean, I would just add to what he said, that it's important to, even as we look at the ways in which history helps to shape the present or helps to shape decisions made in the present, it's also possible simply to diverge from the historical patterns and try something that's new or something that's imported from an entirely different place. As with that, with the Belt and Road Initiative, they're not looking to China's past for a clear sense of how to go about this project. I think this is something new. And that's equally plausible that there are opportunities in history, but history does not necessarily hamstring the choices of the present.
I think the big difference is that China, I mean, the Belt and Road reflects the fact that China recognizes now that the world constitutes more than just its immediate neighborhood, which was part of the Qing worldview. Yep. I think its pursuit of the Belt and Road reflects what I think I referred to earlier, is this combination of both the need and the opportunity to move beyond China's past. I think to the extent that China still sees an external need for the internal requirements of domestic prosperity and economic growth, the Belt and Road certainly plays into that objective. I mean, they're trying to establish access to commodities and markets and energy supplies and economic relationships that can redound back to their broader international benefit. But I think the opportunity element of it is, again, an effort, as I said, to reassert China's place in the world, but in the broader world. The Chinese talk a lot about what they call the need to reform global governance to make it more representative of the balance of power in the 21st century. And I think that's why their ambitions are beyond what they've pursued historically, because they now recognize that the balance of power is something that is truly global, and it's their appropriate place to extend their influence through the Belt and Road Initiative and beyond in terms of their leadership in the global order.
I'm going to come right here in the second row.
Oh, thank you. As Steve Winters, independent consultant, I see a possible maybe critique or criticism of your book. And so I'd just like to shortly say what it might be and then how you would respond to it. But certainly what we're talking about, what you're talking about here at the highest level is modernization theory. And in German historiography, that's very well developed among the historians, and then when they look back at German history, you have this concept of Sonderweg, somehow the Germans didn't quite, they got on the wrong path, and then this led to disaster. And you could really see your book as describing what's happened with China as a Sonderweg. They've departed from the mainstream modernization theory. And that's certainly, when you talk about the policy people here, they're so frustrated over the last 3 years because their concept was it was going to fall into line with that. So the question is that, you know, if somebody said, actually there was a very notorious, well-known German historian who said, if the war had turned out differently, maybe we'd be talking about the Anglo-American Sonderweg and the German great success story. So that's the question.
Good question, really terrific.
Yeah, that's a terrific question, thank you so much. So in the book, I don't really use modernization theory, right? So I begin with explaining that modern is something that's relative. We don't have a clear model for what's modern because, there are many paths to modernity, and that even applies to Europe, or compare Europe to the United States and so on. So that's my starting point. But I also think that I try to make the case very clearly that I don't expect China to go the way many have hoped or dreamed about anytime soon. I mean, I can't rule it out for eternity, but not in the next years. And I think that is, as you said, a general disappointment we have not only about China, right? The world has not fulfilled the expectations. There was so much naivety, especially also in Germany after 89, that the world and also the Eastern Europe would develop according to the way we think is best, namely democracy, liberal systems, but always nowhere has this happened. So I think it's not only a case for China that we have to think about what role history plays, and here I try to be more specific, what role historical institutions play. So my argument is to say, yes, China's a Sonderweg, but there are many, many Sonderwege, if you so will, and they are all based on the fact that countries develop on the basis of their institutions, and some social scientists call this institutional drift. So changes are possible, but as we just learned in the last 30 years, these changes take much more time, much more effort, need to be much more comprehensive, so it's not coming out of itself.
Okay. All right, we're going to come here in the front row again, getting a lot of exercise for our interns.
Xin Fan, SUNY Fredonia. So I have a question here for you. I guess as historians, we're first and foremost storytellers, right? We're telling a story. And in this book, you're trying to tell a story. Someone is making China modern. So I guess my question for you is, who is the subject of action, right? So who is making China modern? Or Xi Jinping, or Qing Dynasty, or something else, or the institution, our institution, people, our institution can initiate the action or in historical context.
Yeah. Great question.
That's also a great question. And in the book, of course, I try, in general, to put leaders in to assign to the leaders a much smaller role. Why I still, of course, mention Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, but in my story, they become actually much less important. So I look instead of institutions, but who are institutions? That's a good question. So that's actually people, the agents, people who participate in the institutions. So a great part of my story, at least as I understand it, is actually one where I try to give agency to people or groups of people that are normally not really factored in when historians write about China. So for instance, when China becomes strong in the last 40 years, I believe, much of it is due to the way people respond and use opportunities given by the new institutions. It's much less the leaders or policymakers, but it's actually the revival of these institutions that needs a lot of people to participate and make them to something useful. So I tried, the reason why I wanted, you know, to form a different perspective was exactly to get back away from elite politics, which I don't think is one cannot, of course, completely, you know, ignore it, but it's not the best way to think about the Chinese development.
So let me pivot off of Xin Fan's question then. I wrote down Jack Ma's great leader.
Absolutely.
Yeah, of course. And so But I want to say, when you began, I was thinking, oh, this would be a book that official historians in Beijing might like, the explanation of China's successful rejuvenation. But the more you talk, the more I think, I'm not so sure they'd like this book. So could you talk about how, I guess two things, what type of reception do you think this would get from either officialdom or official historiographers in China? And secondly, about how officialdom uses history in a way that maybe is different from the way you talk about history.
This is,
and you all welcome to comment on this too.
Yeah, that's very hard for me to say because I wrote this book where I use materials from China, and I have been in China and gave some talks about this, but not, of course, I didn't have encounters with officialdom. I can only say that when I talked parts of the book, there was a considerable interest in China, also going beyond historians. But that might also be simply curiosity because they want to know how a foreigner, looks at China's rise or something like this. But I really don't know. I can't tell you how this is conceived. I don't think that there are certain parts in it that will make a reception in China difficult. Let's leave it like that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Do you guys comment?
Well, I thought the book did a great job of highlighting the fact that even though. In fact, I was hoping this issue would come up of how the Chinese, the Communist Party, certainly uses and manipulates history, which they clearly do. And the two thoughts I have there is that, to a certain extent, I think the Chinese leadership does itself a disservice because there's enough in the actual history for them that's true to make their points. Without coming up with these doctored and very selective versions of it, and the versions which generally exclude the self-inflicted wounds that the Chinese regimes over years have imposed upon themselves. The second thought is, I thought you did an excellent job, Klaus, of highlighting something which I think is overlooked, which is notwithstanding the regime's manipulation of history and propaganda, their propagandistic version of the century humiliation, there is, I think you called it, there's an independent existence for popular nationalism, which is a double-edged sword for the leadership. It's not all propaganda, and it's not all too long ago to be irrelevant. And I think this is something that worries the regime. Well, we've seen many episodes where there have been anti-foreign demonstrations, which are always close to becoming anti-regime demonstrations, and they've had to contain them, because there is genuine nationalism, not just that that's created by the party.
Yeah. So in sort of the broader view of how somebody in government might read this book. I can show it again. One of the themes that runs through this is that one of the greatest sources of China's weakness in the past was not having enough government. The decline from which China is still trying to recover, the decline of the Qing dynasty under Qianlong, as you point out, it comes about because Qianlong's grandfather, Kangxi, issued an edict towards the end of his reign promising that the government would never raise the land taxes again, which is, accounted for about 80% of the government's income. And under Qianlong in the 18th century, which is seen as the golden age, the pinnacle of Chinese power, this is the nostalgic vision that Xi Jinping is trying to bring China back to now. During that period, China's population doubled, but the government could not keep up because it was hamstrung by its revenues. And you point out that there were only 30,000 officials to govern a population of 300 or 400 million people, and that much of the decline and the corruption that came into the regime and a lot of the internal factors of rebellion were due to that. You also point out that when the communists came to power in 1949, this was something that I hadn't known, this was very surprising to me, that the Communist Party members only accounted for about 1% of the population. There were 4 or 5 million of them ready to try to establish their legitimacy with a population of 500 million. So, not being entirely facetious, but somebody in government could look at this and say, yep, we need more. Increase revenues, we need more officials. Problems can come from not establishing enough control over society. I think another sort of counterintuitive line that comes through this also is that there are warnings in here for reformers. of ways in which reforms ultimately weakened the country more than saved them. I mean, the classic example being the end of the Qing dynasty, when it's trying to transform itself into a constitutional monarchy, when it modernizes its military, and it's that military which overthrows it ultimately. And that if they had been a little more conservative, maybe they would not have created the civil society that was able to undo them. So somebody could read this in terms of be very cautious in reform, be careful in how you depart from established ways of doing things.
Okay. I think we've got time for one more question. We're going to come right here.
Hi, I'm Dixon Yeo. I'm a PhD candidate with the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, National University of Singapore, and I'm with the Elliott School as well. So this is kind of a convoluted question, so I just like to unpack it in my mind a bit. I understand that, Prof, you actually chose the Qing Dynasty because of its proximity to the modern era in the context of this book, and if you were to actually hop on to other dynasties like the Ming or the Yuan, it would extend. This book probably will be three times bigger than what it is right now. So my question is that have you ever come across this perception in China that, in a sense, the Qing was considered an alien dynasty, not of Han descent, and that in China there isn't always a view that the Qing is the pinnacle of Chinese civilization, that it was much earlier, the Ming, not even the Yuan, but the Tang. But that's a much bigger book, so that's one thing.
Longer. Right. It's going to be longer and heavier. Yeah, like,
and I think that in the discussion of the book that you actually sort of like examined the rise and the recovery of China in the early part of the Qing Dynasty, after the chaos at the end of the Ming, and then to the height of the Qianlong and so on, and then subsequently to the collapse. I'm just wondering, when it comes to direct historical parallels, do you think that, for instance, a gentleman earlier had actually suggested that if we were to actually take historical parallels, we would be saying something like the European religious wars in the late 18th century and how it sort of extends into the history of the EU and how it impacts the EU and how it operates right now. A similar book could be written by, say, an Asian or a Chinese historian and examining the West in this way. So, I mean, do you think that sometimes it's also a path dependency in perception and the period that you choose, which actually highlights what is considered a rise and what is considered a fall? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, it's a convoluted question, but yeah.
That's good. Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I'd like to start by pointing out that, of course, in the book, I argue that there is no, you know, that Chinese nationalism or the notion of what China is, that arises, to my mind, relatively late. So, you know, as a simple historian, I always say, you know, if, for instance, a international treaty isn't signed by an entity that's called China, yeah, then it's doubtful to me if China exists. So I say the notion of China comes relatively late, and then it becomes a powerful argument against an alien dynasty. But I doubt that, that the Qing, of course, were Manchu, and that was clearly visible, and that was because you had Manchu documents and so on everywhere. But I kind of challenge a little bit that Chinese nationalism existed before the modern period. And so, therefore, I think it was completely seen that was a Senate, a pinnacle. Of course, later on, nationalists in China would no longer look to the Qing dynasty. You're absolutely right. They would go either to the Ming, their last great Chinese or Han Chinese dynasty. But I don't see that kind of contradiction really playing out much before the modern period. And then the second question, if I got it right, what you mean, I mean, in terms of the past dependency and so on, and these questions, I think, of course, you can write a similar story in regarding to Western countries. I would think that's entirely possible. And the question is, what is rise and fall? My book is not really about rise and fall. My starting point was to say that the earlier literature or the other literature was kind of obsessed, as has been also said by my commentators here, with a China lagging behind. My starting point is, as has been said, now we have to accept the situation has changed for whatever reason. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily, you know, rising is regard to falling, and I'm actually not interested in these idioms of rising and falling. I don't think that China has risen, because there are many problems that are still unresolved. So I don't generally don't think that's a really good category to think about. That's why I focus on institutions and try to reconstruct the processes in these various sectors, from economy, from markets, and so on, and then finding out that there is no such thing as a complete rise. And I think it's a myth also for other areas in the world.
I mean, I would add to that yes, on the one hand, there's the 5,000 years of Chinese history and that tradition and whatnot, but in the most concrete term, the reason for the Qing Dynasty, I think, is because the People's Republic of China takes as its territory essentially the territory of the Qing Dynasty, minus Mongolia, Taiwan up in the air still. That gives the Qing a proximity to the modern state that, as sort of the inheritors of that particular territory, that would, I think, be very different. I mean, if the revolutionaries in 1911 had stuck with their pure Han nationalistic tone and overthrew the Manchus and simply held onto the territory of the Ming, I wonder how China would be different in the world right now.
Klaus, thank you. Thank you for this book. Historians owe a debt of gratitude toward you. I'm sure your colleagues in the field will be using your book, citing your book,
cribbing from your book in our lectures,
stealing from your book for a long time. But thank you from the policy community's perspective, as Paul said, rescuing the policy community from an ahistorical view of China and our relationship with it. This is something that we struggle with mightily every day, and as institutions, it's an institutional problem for us. And so so your visit and the book are very important. Thank you both for your comments as well, for the discussion with the audience. If you all join me in thanking Klaus and our Paul and Steve.
Thank you.